Hello and welcome to the Game Theory Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Ficini. We're presented by The Athletic. Today on the show, Nekias Duncan is in the building, and we're going to talk about a variety of issues because this is a 21 questions podcast. We did this a couple weeks ago with Danny LaRue, and we had a lot of fun. It got a really good sense of feedback from the listeners. So we're going to do it again with another guy that knows the NBA about as well as anyone that I know. He hosts the Dunker Spot with Steve Jones. He hosts, what is your show with Jasmine called, Nekias?
It's called You Late.
He hosts You Late with Jasmine Watkins. He writes at Basketball News. Please, please give a beautiful welcome to Nekias Duncan. Nekias, how you doing, man?
I am doing pretty well. It's been a hectic 36 hours or so on the personal side. But other than that, I am good. I'm healthy, loving all the basketball that's going on right now. Feels like I haven't had a real break since the WNBA season ended. Just kind of flowed right into regular season NBA basketball, but it's been a lot of fun.
I'm so glad that everything has worked out. Nekias had a bit of a fire issue over the early portion of this week. Everything worked out though. Everything is good. That's the most important part here. And we are just going to dive right in to the questions here. We're going to run through the Miami Heat. We're going to run through the Chicago Bulls, maybe some stuff on the Celtics. We're going to talk, a bit about the fouling issue that has, been interesting to track throughout the course of the NBA season with the different interpretation of fouling rules. We have a lot of different stuff here. Obviously, 21 topics. So let's just dive right in. Nekias, question number one. Do you think the Miami Heat has been the best team in the NBA this season? Because for me, I think they've been the most complete, overall strongest team that I've seen so far this year.
I want to say yes, because they have been very good. Like, at bare minimum, like, this has been the most fun I've had watching a Heat team in quite some time, just from a play style perspective. I'll probably say no, just because I still have some questions about the half court that I don't have with, like, Golden State, for example. But Miami's been really freaking good. Their defense has been absurd, the way they've been able to switch, the way they've been able to play drop now since they have Kyle Lowry at the point of attack, as opposed to a Goran Dragic or a Kendrick Nunn. So it's been nice that they can actually mix in more coverages because they want to and not because they're worried their guys at the point of attack are going to get blown by. And that defense has juiced their transition attack. And Kyle Lowry's been a big part of that. Being able to push off of makes and after misses, the quick hit aheads, finding shooters. He's really empowered a guy like Bam Adebayo in the half court. I'm really enjoying this Heat team. I'll just put it that way.
Yeah, like I'm most blown away, I think, by the integration of Kyle Lowry, like, into this entire scheme, because, like, Kyle is coming from being, look, he's long been one of the most unselfish players, and he has long been a player that just makes the right decision at all times. But it was still more of a primary role in Toronto, and he has completely taken a step back and been completely unselfish with how a guy, for instance, like a, Bam Adebayo is taking more touches than he is. And he absolutely is getting more touches than Kyle Lowry is so far. And Jimmy Butler is obviously going to get more touches than Kyle Lowry, but Kyle's just really happy driving their transition attack. He's really happy, just being unselfish and getting guys the ball in the spots they need to get to. He's long been one of the best pass placement guys in the NBA. Like, he just puts it right in the shooting pocket every time. He puts it right into an advantageous spot for a drive every single time. The fit of Kyle Lowry in Miami has just been so incredibly seamless, and that's where I'm most impressed with Miami right now.
He's been a godsend. Again, for all the questions I had about the half-court offense last year, and I still have a little bit this year, like, the easiest way to mitigate those concerns is to not play half-court basketball. And he's been instrumental in kind of pushing the pace there. And I'm glad you brought up the fact that, you know, his passing placement and stuff. Like, he has really empowered Bam Adebayo in particular. And shout out to Brady Hawk at Fire Reason Sports. They do a great job covering the Miami Heat as a whole. One thing that he's pointed out multiple times throughout this year is, like, Bam will get the ball on the left block. And last year, if he didn't see an immediate advantage, he'll look for a shooter, flow to a dribble handoff, or swing the ball to Jimmy, and they get into something else late clock. He'll pitch the ball to Kyle Lowry, and Kyle Lowry just post-entry right back to him. Like, no, go, ISO, attack. Like, no, you're not getting out of this. Be aggressive. And I think that's going to be so huge for him moving forward, because I think aggression is really the only thing that's holding Bam back from being a premier offensive hub among the center position.
You mentioned the defense, and we didn't talk enough about the defense, but we have to move on to this second question here. I am at the point where I definitely trust Jimmy Butler, Bam Adebayo. I definitely trust Kyle Lowry within this scheme. We 100% trust Duncan Robinson just to be a floor spacer, right? But do we trust what we've seen from Tyler Hero so far? Because this has been like a 2-week star turn at this point, right? Like, we're at the point where, like, what we've seen from Tyler Hero, he's been like an incredible 23 point per game combo guard who is doing it not only on his own terms, but he's doing it within the flow of the offense, creating plays for others. Do you buy into the leap we've seen from Tyler Hero in these 2 weeks?
I think his progression is very much real. I do think the game has slowed down for him some. This is already a guy that played with an incredible amount of craft, already has the shooting touch, has, even as a rookie, made solid reads like a secondary ball handler. The issue there was like he didn't have the burst or the handle to, you know, operate as a primary in the half court. But he's always been able to see the floor well. And so now that you have that, combined with experience, combined with an actual offseason for him, combined with him being physically stronger, so he's not getting knocked off his spots as much on drives, I think all of his offensive progress is real. Do I think the volume is going to hold up? I don't think so, because I think as Kyle Lowry shoots better, as Duncan Robinson finds his three-point stroke, like outside of the Memphis game, he just has not shot well. But like, as those guys get more comfortable, like, I don't think Tyler's going to be relied on to be a 20 point per game guy, but I do think he's this good. Like, I don't think anything he's shown from like a process standpoint is fake.
Yeah, I agree with you. I was a little bit surprised with the amount of hate that he got last year. Like, I know that he had his problems last year, but it felt like a lot of that came from people who were trying to extrapolate what Tyler's life seems like it is off the court, which seems very fun, into trying to create a narrative that he wasn't necessarily bringing it on the court. And again, like, I don't want to say that Tyler Hero had an incredible sophomore year, but anytime that a guy's 21 years old and averages 15 points, almost 4 assists and 5 rebounds, and shoots like 44% from the field and 36% from three and 80% from the line, like, that seems like pretty good development wise for me, right? Like, I know he hit a bit of a wall, but it feels like he was a victim of the expectation game last year, maybe, when combined with his like off court stuff, people were just looking to find a narrative to bring him down, and maybe that motivated him this summer. I don't know, but he looks like he's taken the leap that we hoped he would take.
Yeah, again, like, having an actual offseason helps. I think it just went a little bit too far. Like, I hear the notion about like bubble hero because he had that 37 point game against Boston or whatever, and, you know, second year proves that bubble hero was a fluke. And it's just like, outside of the 37 point game against Boston during that playoff run, like, he shot worse from three during that postseason run than he did during the regular season. So it wasn't even like he got this massive bump. Yeah. And then you look at last year, he dealt with injuries, the Heat dealt with injuries and COVID. He was a point guard and they had it coming off the bench. Then he was starting or operating the secondary role with all of this roster flux around him. So like, the fact that he was able to put up the numbers he did with decent efficiency, it's honestly impressive. So now that you have more of a, again, like, he has an actual off season, you have more talent around him. The second units with him and Kyle Lowry have just been blitzing teams so far.
Yep.
He's in a role that makes sense for him. And so, like, even now, as he's looking better as like a secondary guy and he's averaging over 20 points per game, I do think some of the on ball reps that he was force fed at the beginning of last season, you know, he starts the gauntlet last year against Drew Holiday and Lonzo Ball when he was in New Orleans. Like, he had himself an opening stretch of the season that was not fun for him. But I think that experience helped him. And now he's even more comfortable in that he's actually slotted into the role that fits him.
Let's go to number three. The Chicago Bulls are the team I've probably enjoyed watching more than any team other than the Miami Heat in the Eastern Conference so far this year. Do you believe in the Bulls yet? And how much do we think that Pat Williams injury is going to hinder them?
Honestly, I'm getting there. I had concerns about their defense heading into the year. I didn't really trust Vucevic as like a play at the level of the screen type guy that he would need to be to kind of compensate for the rest of his roster. And I didn't trust DeMar DeRozan on the back line. Patrick Williams basically replacing Thaddeus Young as like that back line rover was something that I had an eye on. Now Pat Williams is out, but the defense has been much better than expected. The offense, though it's been good, is kind of lagging behind. That is just not what I expected to see from this Bulls team. Like, everyone is competing. Lonzo has been incredible. Alex Caruso has been incredible at the point of attack. It's, they're piecing it together. And like, even some of the pieces that they're fitting in off the bench, like Derrick Jones Jr. comes out. I've, as someone that's watched him closely in Miami, if he can't do anything else, he can fly around defensively.
Yep.
Javonte Green has been, he's just been the energizer bunny on both ends of the floor, really, but particularly defensively. They are plugging these gaps with this aggressive scheme. I just want to see what this looks like. I mean, they're in the midst of a tough schedule right now, a tough stretch in their schedule. So I want to see what the rest of it looks like, because they're going to be facing some good offenses, but they're making believers out of me right now.
Yeah, for them to have beaten Utah and then to come back and then also beat Boston by 14 in like a 19-point comeback last night, and we'll talk about that other team there in a minute, but it was an incredibly impressive little two-game stretch. And on top of that, I mean, they had that one-point loss to the Knicks that really kicked off this difficult part of their schedule. Look, I was higher on this Knicks team, or this Bulls team, I'm sorry, coming into the year. I actually just kind of really believed in them in terms of them being able to fit together offensively in a really coherent way. I had the same defensive concerns as you, but I had hopes that Lonzo and Alex Caruso could really kind of stem the tide, and that Zach LaVine coming back from USA Basketball and in a free agency year would really kind of play as hard as he could defensively for a number of reasons. But man, like I'm just really impressed with Chicago. I think that they're legit. Like, I think this is probably, look, I don't know if they're a top four team. I don't know if they're a top three team in the East. Like, I still believe in Miami more. I still believe in Milwaukee more. I still believe in Brooklyn more, certainly, but like, they're right in the mix, given the uncertainty of what Philadelphia is going to look like in 2 months if a Ben Simmons deal happens. I think that they're just kind of right in the mix for that number four seed, and I would bet that this is a playoff team, not a play-in team at this point.
Yeah, they had that upside. Like, heading into the year, I did a big season preview for basketballnews.com, went through each division. So I had, like, a high range and a low range for Chicago. Like, I ended up kind of ending on them being a play-in team. But like, I feel like the offense is going to be good. Like, the fact that they're a good offense despite Nikola Vucevic just not being able to hit anything for the first week and a half of the season, I think that bodes incredibly well for them. The defense just really impressed me. Like, they are creating turnovers at a rate that I didn't know was possible, to be frank with you. So I wonder what it's going to look like if that ties down. I would imagine there's going to be at least some regression there moving forward. But just this general commitment and the way that they're flying around and rotating, I'm really impressed.
Okay, let's go to number four, which is also a Chicago Bulls question. And this is like a Homer Game Theory podcast question, right? I am an enormous DeMar DeRozan fan. I say that with no... I want people to know where this question comes from here. But is DeMar DeRozan closer to being a Hall of Famer than what we think? So, here's my case. By the end of the year, DeMar DeRozan will probably be right around like 55th all-time in scoring. At the end of next year, assuming he averages just 20 points a night, which would be a come down from what his current level is, over 80 games, he'll be right around 43rd all-time in points. All of the top 48 scorers in NBA history are in the Hall of Fame. DeMar DeRozan has made multiple all-NBA teams. He's really well-respected by NBA players, like other players. I'm just like saying, like, are we looking at a Hall of Fame career that we aren't recognizing in the moment? Or is the fact that we aren't recognizing it in the moment a statement that maybe he shouldn't be a Hall of Famer?
Like, if I just zoom out and think, like, is DeMar DeRozan a Hall of Fame level player? Like, my answer would probably be no, because I just have a strict line on that. But if you look at some of the names that are actually in the Basketball Hall of Fame, and you look at what DeMar DeRozan is averaging for his career, You just mentioned how many career points he has and probably will have, barring something catastrophic. He does have the two All-NBA teams. He's a four-time All-Star, might be five if he keeps this up throughout the year. Either the fans or the coaches will vote him in at this rate. So that gives him five. Like, he certainly has a Hall of Fame case. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if he eventually got in.
It's not that far off, and it's just like kind of crazy to me, given he came up in this era of like analytics. And like, look, I use analytics as much as everyone does. I use numbers as much as everyone does, but it always felt like people who utilize numbers fought to like push against his game without recognizing, like, it was in the infancy of the use of analytics without recognizing how valuable his shot creation was. And that ended up pushing him down these, like, you know, yearly player lists. Like, there were multiple times where I remember headlines, DeMar DeRozan is not a top 40 player in the NBA per this number or per like this voting thing. Like, that just ended up being crazy. And I am very blown away by the way that DeMar DeRozan has immediately fit in to the Chicago Bulls team. He averaged, or he had 37 in that comeback win against Boston last night. He had 32 in the game against Utah. His mid-range game has worked absolutely perfectly within this scheme. He's attacking the basket just as much as we've seen. He's taking more threes than we saw him take in San Antonio and hitting them at 41% on a very, very small sample size thus far. Man, this guy looks like an all-star right now, and I wonder if we are we're not appreciating it enough in the time that it's happening, I guess.
I feel like there are – we don't have to hang on this too long. I just feel like two different conversations that happen with DeMar DeRozan. It's like the shot creation is important, and I think that should be valued. And I think as analytics have risen, not that it's the right application, but so many people at least branded as analytics equals threes. And that's a whole nother podcast that we can get into about how that doesn't begin to describe what analytics actually are. But like, I do think he was a bit unfairly penalized because of that. Like, as you mentioned, the shot creation is very important, and he is very good at operating in the mid post. The playmaking has gotten better. And then there's also the regular season versus playoff burden, in which he has had some very notable flameouts throughout his career. So I wonder like how that's going to be balanced when he actually retires.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Let's go to number five here. The Chicago Bulls played the Boston Celtics last night. Boston might just be a mess. Anytime I've watched Boston, they look like a total disaster in defense, especially in transition. And then offensively, like, it doesn't look like this team enjoys playing with one another. Where are you on Boston right now?
I was, full disclosure, like, I had M.A. Udoka as my coach of the year pick because I thought Boston was firmly going to be a playoff team this year. So I'm coming in, like, I was high on Boston coming in, assuming health. And they have just not looked like a cohesive basketball team. Like, Jason Tatum hasn't gotten his legs under him. Jaylen Brown has been pretty hit or miss. And even M.A. Udoka has made note of that in a presser. Like, I don't know which Jaylen Brown I'm going to get or what kind of energy he's going to bring, which is not something that you want to hear from your new head coach about one of your star players less than 2 weeks into a season. Not necessarily ideal. And I'll make this comparison. This may be the only time I compare the Celtics to the Kings at any point throughout the season. But watching them on defense, and this is something that Steve and I talked about on the Dunker Spot last year, soft switching irks my nerves.
Yeah.
And this Boston team, if you look in a player's direction, they are ready to dunk under a screen and switch something. And, like, God bless Al Horford, who has he been their second best player this year?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Like, no question.
So,
it's probably third, but, like, he's been their most important of the, like, role guys consistently.
Right. So, like, even if the fact that he's even in that discussion says more about at least one of, if not both of the stars than it does about Horford. But particularly defensively, that man is trying his best. And, like, this just, he just should not be tasked with what he's being tasked with. And he's, last time I checked, like, he was leading the league in blocks, which that's not going to stand. But, yeah, the defense doesn't seem to play with any real purpose. The offense, with all the talk MA had before the year about ball movement and how they wanted to pressure the rim a little bit more, and they wanted to get the stars easier looks, they wanted the stars to create looks for others, it's been a lot of iso ball still. Like, nothing's really changed. So I am concerned right now.
Yeah, I'm concerned. I mean, I don't know. Then you had Marcus Smart come out last night and say that, like, basically Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum need to pass a little bit more. They need to look to pass more, or they don't want to pass in those late game situations. I think that those quotes got 10% taken out of context. Like, it was clear that Marcus Smart was like trying to make a point, it felt like, but I think that they were framed a bit more aggressively than what maybe Marcus Smart mentioned and like wanted it to feel. But yeah, it feels like they just have a lot of problems right now in Boston. Like, just a lot of problems at this point. let's go to question number 6. So what do you think of the foul calls that have happened so far league-wide and the different interpretation of fouling on shooting fouls particularly? Are you a fan of essentially fewer fouls are being called on these shots? Do you think that there's room for improvement in terms of the way that the game is being called? Are you a bigger fan of this style of game than last year's style of game? Just what are your thoughts on officiating thus far this season?
As someone that loves defense, I am glad that things have gotten a little bit tighter on that front. Or I guess I should say a little bit looser on that front. I'm glad there's a little bit more physicality, particularly on the perimeter. I do like that they've kind of gotten out some of the, I don't want to say cheap, but I'm struggling to think of a better word. So I guess the cheap stuff where you pump fake a guy, then you jump 3 feet sideways to get into his line of sight and draw the foul. Like, I don't want to see that stuff. With that being said, yes, there's absolutely room for improvement. You can eliminate some of the, you know, the arm hooking and stuff like that without deciding not to call fouls in the paint period. Like, there has to be a better balance with that. Like, Trae Young honestly has a point. In which some guys are, like, the smaller guards in particular, but guys are getting hammered in the paint. And the wrestler is like, nah, play ball. Like, there has to be a better balance there. Like, get rid of the stuff that clearly aren't basketball moves. Also, get rid of the Euro foul. I think it's time out for that.
Yes. That is actually my number one concern right now. Like, there are, I think that Bob Vulgaris tweeted a stat that something like 8% of transition opportunities are being stopped by Euro fouls right now. And that just needs to end. Like, it's just so consistent. It's literally stopping the game, making the game longer, and making it less exciting. Like, for the love of God, please, competition committee, whatever you are called, please get rid of the Euro foul.
Yeah, we got to curb that one, at least. But yeah, like, a little bit better balance with paint play, and then I'm all good. Like, I like it overall, but that's the obvious area for improvement for me.
Okay, and then number 7, speaking of the fouling issue, do we buy this narrative that some players have been affected by the new interpretation of the rules? Like, do we think James Harden is struggling with this new interpretation, or do we think he's just, like, frankly working his way back into game shape right now?
I think it's just him working into game shape. I don't really buy into that. I think a lot of people want to run with that because that's the easier thing to do, and that gets you the retweets on NBA Twitter, which, fair. But honestly, like, that's a small percentage of it. Like, James Harden is too good. He's too smart. More than anything, for that to be the issue, why he's just suddenly not an all-star anymore or something ridiculous. Like, he's going to be fine.
Yeah, the bigger problem for me with James Harden is that he can't separate from anyone right now because he looks heavy out there. Like, James Harden's always been a thick guy, but, like, he looks a little bit thicker than what is normal. And I'm sure that by, like, January, he's going to be in more normal condition for where he is and is going to look like a star again. Like, James Harden right now is averaging 19 points, 8 rebounds, 8 assists per game. He's still been effective because of what you said, Nikias. He's so smart and intelligent and just knows how to, like, draw defenders toward him. But, like, the guy can't elevate at all. He can't separate right now. And that's just going to change, I think, by the time January rolls around, right?
Yeah, like, it's going to be fine. Like, we're going to have this 3-week stretch in, like, January or something where he's averaging, like, 28, 9, and 12. And we're going to have MVP articles being written about him. And we're going to just forget about this entire opening stretch. It's all going to look ridiculous.
Yeah. Okay, let's take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. Okay, we're back here. Let's go to question number 8. This is just a simple one. Who's your favorite League Pass team so far, Nikias?
Favorite League Pass team for me right now, if I'm excluding Miami, it's probably Cleveland, funny enough.
Woo, love that choice.
I don't want to spoil it because we're going to talk about them a little bit later, but I am enjoying a lot of their players right now.
We'll move that question up and talk about it here in a minute, but continue on some of the other guys that you really like so far.
Oh, like, quick shout out to Lauri Markkanen, who I panned the trade as soon as it happened. Like, why would you give up Larry Nance Jr. and get Lauri Markkanen back? Why would you add another big to this rotation? Why would you try to play Lauri Markkanen at the 3 on purpose? And it has worked to this point of the season. We'll see if that works long term, but, like, he is spacing the floor, like, just from where he's standing. Like, he's moving well off the ball. He's shooting the ball. He's really competing on defense. Like, we've seen a lot of big, big pick and rolls involving him that have generated some fruitful stuff. Like, he is in this wonky role on this wonky team, and he's making it work. So that's probably the biggest one. Colin Sexton seems a little bit more comfortable playing off the ball, which is fun.
Yep.
Darius Garland, when he's been out there, has been good. So I've enjoyed watching Cleveland so far.
Yeah, I think that with Lowry, what the deal is just having someone who can make shots has opened up so much for their offense. This is a team that, like, really just genuinely did not have, like, a wing shooter last year. And Lowry is not a wing shooter. He's a big shooter. But even just playing him in lineups has created space for those guards in a way that they just, like, frankly, did not have last year. Like, nobody guards Isaac Okoro outside of 20 feet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was about to say, that's the big one. It surprised me when they announced that they were going to start him over Isaac Okoro. I was like, huh. Like, I get why, but that's an interesting shift, especially with Isaac actually looking pretty good towards the second half of the season. But to your point, like, the spacing has just been huge for them. Just even when they're running a pick and roll and they'll have Lauri in the corner and have him lift to the wing, like, whoever's tagging the roll man has to keep an eye on Lauri Markkanen. And that's not something you say about even Chetty Osmond, who really got those shots up last year, or especially Isaac Okoro, who, as you mentioned, teams just do not guard him. Just that subtle shift has made the half-court offense flow a lot smoother.
And then let's go to the big reason why I think Cleveland has been incredible to watch so far this year. I mean, you don't really watch college basketball, and you don't do any sort of, like, draft work, but you've now seen this rookie class for a couple of weeks, and how pumped are you about what you've seen from Evan Mobley? I mean, he's literally just, like, completely transformed Cleveland's defense, I think.
He's so fun. He brings me so much joy when I watch. Outside of him setting screens, that's the one thing where I'm just like, brother, please hold your contact. What's happening right now? We did a rookie episode of the Dunker Spot last week, and I said, like, Evan Mobley's one of the worst screeners in the NBA right now. And then I'd immediately praise him for, like, 5 minutes after that. He's so much fun outside of the screen. The defense, as you mentioned, like, he can move on the perimeter. He looks like he's been in the league for, like, 8 years playing drop coverage. And that's just not a thing you should say about rookie bigs. He looks incredibly comfortable in drop. You can play him higher. You can switch him. And he's just good. He's so good at basketball.
Well, like, the crazy thing for me is, like, the help defense instincts already. Like, think about, like, how often guys like Darius Garland and Colin Sexton get beaten off the dribble at the point of attack, because they do. Like, it's fine. You know, they're young guards. They're small. Bigger guys can take advantage of them. And he's just always there. Like, he's always there to cover up their tracks. It's an enormous, enormous credit to him that, like, I don't quite think he's, like, all defense level yet, but if someone wants to make that case, I'll at least listen. Like, I'll at least hear it out that, like, he could be on that team right now.
And, like, even if you disagree with that, which I don't, like, I do think he has a fringe case right now. Like, he wouldn't make, you know, can I take the opportunity to say, can we please get an all defensive third team? there's no reason we shouldn't have a third team. I mean, there is a reason, but that's another podcast. Yeah,
I love it. Let's do it.
He definitely has a fringe case right now. And, like, even if you disagree with that, the fact that that's a plausible conversation starter for a rookie big man should let you know how good this man is.
I can't remember the last rookie who has been this impactful defensively. Like, we can talk about Davion Mitchell, and I really like Davion Mitchell's point of attack defense, but, like, Davion Mitchell is doing, like, one aspect of defense at a truly difference-making level, right? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, he's a good help defender who's always in position, but he's just small, right? Like, it's harder for him to make an impact. Evan Mobley is succeeding at literally every aspect of NBA team defense right now, and I am completely blown away. He would be my rookie of the year, like, unquestionably right now. Like, I all due respect to Scottie Barnes, all due respect to Franz Wagner, Josh Giddey, you know, all of these other rookies who have performed really well. Like, Evan Mobley has been so good so far.
He has been so good. Like, I probably have Barnes as, like, 1A and Mobley 1B just because of the offensive responsibility. But, like, that's I'm not pushing back hard on Evan Mobley for rookie year. He's been that good.
Yeah. Okay, let's go to question number 10. The Atlanta Hawks are taking more mid-range jumpers than any other team in the NBA this season and fewer above the break threes than any other team outside of Chicago and Phoenix. When you're a team that has Trae Young, who takes a ton of pull-up above the break threes, Kevin Huerter, Bogdan Bogdanovic, Cam Reddish, DeAndre Hunter, this seems like a stylistic concern right now. How worried are we about the Nate McMillan era in its first full season offensively in Atlanta?
I also throw in John Collins as an above the break, like, pick and pop big.
Yeah, totally.
I don't want to go there, but watching some of their offensive film from this year, there's so much going wrong structurally for me.
Yeah.
And I preface this with, like, I'm not, like, an NBA coach, so I could very well just be wrong. But from what I've seen, like, the spacing has seemed off for them. Some of the minor details of some of the half-court sets they run have been off. And it's just getting them late into the clock. And then there's also, like, at some points it feels like they're not spacing correctly. And then at other points it feels like they're just playing, like, a playoff 2 minutes left in the game type game plan for 48 minutes. And, like, that's not a brand of basketball you win with during the regular season with this personnel. Like, there were so many DeAndre Hunter post-ups against Seth Curry in the Philly game in which they got blown out in. And I'm just like, I get it, but also there are better players on the floor. You can get guys moving a little bit. Like, let's stress the defense some. Let's not run double drag with the sole purpose of swinging the ball around and getting DeAndre Hunter posted up. You can get that late in the clock. Don't start with that. That's just, it's just weird.
The choices, like you said, it's, I don't even know that it's, like, spacing. I think it's, like, the structural choices being made, like, what they try to do, how they try to attack. Like, it almost feels like they're using the early portion of the regular season more experimentally this year, whereas they might not, like, I worry that they might not be good enough to do that. Like, they're a good team that is definitely, at the very least, a play-in team. In terms of talent, they should just be, like, a full-stop playoff team. Mm-hmm. But I don't know if they're good enough to be able to, like, say for the first, you know, 20 games of the season, hey, we're going to experiment here. We're going to get DeAndre Hunter involved, like, in post-ups. We're going to, you know, try and run some, like, weird pick-and-pops with Danilo Gallinari or something like that, like, as opposed to, like, using him in the mid-post like he is successful at, right? Like, it feels like they're doing a lot more different stuff in order to maybe expand the, like, tool bag later in the season, but I don't know that they're good enough to do that.
Honestly, if you frame it that way, that they're using the early portion of the season as, like, an experimental grounds, like, I probably feel better about Atlanta. Because right now, I'm just flat out concerned about what I've seen, particularly on the offensive end. So, if the case being made is that they're just experimenting right now, then, honestly, I'm fine, because I do think they're good enough to do so. I do believe in their depth. I believe in their top-end talent. Like, in the midst of this mess, like, Trey, as he's adjusting to the foul things, like, he's still been pretty good.
Yeah.
John Collins may be having the best season of his career right now on both ends of the floor. So, like, there are still good things happening in Atlanta. And so if this is just experimental stuff and they're going to say, okay, we can just go double drag heavy offense whenever we want to, like, I at least understand that bit. The flip side of that is we also have years and years and years of Nate McMillan running NBA offense. So, like, it's kind of hard to give him the benefit of the doubt on that.
Yeah, that's where I'm like, I don't know, I guess, is the thing. Like, I don't know if they're experimenting. Like, it seems like that might be the case. But like you said, like, we've seen Nate McMillan for 10 years as a coach in the NBA, and this doesn't look all that different from Nate McMillan's 10 years as a coach. So, like, I don't know. It seems strange to me. I hope that Atlanta goes back to running very fun offense sooner rather than later, because Trae Young is incredibly fun, and he's still incredibly fun, but there's probably space for him to be even more fun than what he's been thus far. Let's go to number 11 here. Up until last night against Toronto, the Knicks have been running just some sweet, beautiful half-court offense. They were literally first in the NBA in points per possession out of the half-court per synergy at 1.033 points per half-court possession. Do we trust that that is actually going to hold over the course of the full season?
No, I don't think the Knicks are going to have the best half-court offense in the NBA. However, I will say that it is refreshing that Julius Randle and RJ Barrett aren't operating in phone booths like they were last year.
Yep.
Adding NBA players that can shoot the basketball and can do so off of movement or can do so off the dribble means that there are more dribble drive opportunities. That means there are multiple options within your half court offense, and things can just kind of flow from one option to the next. Like, that's how it's supposed to work. That's why you add Kemba Walker, even at the stage. This is why you add Evan Fournier. You can keep the chain moving. You can use Julius Randle as the tip of the spear, or you can end possessions with him if you need to, and you have other competent offensive players. So I have enjoyed watching the Knicks in the half court this year.
Yeah, the only thing I will say is I don't think they're going to have the number one half court offense in the league, if only because right now they're shooting 41% from three. Like, no team is going to shoot 41% from three over the course of the entire season. Having said that, I think structurally their offense makes a lot more sense. Like, they are taking over 40 threes per game. They're in the top 10 in the league in terms of 3-point attempts. They are getting to the foul line a ton, because even though this, you know, the way that the game is being officiated has changed, that doesn't stop Julius Randle from getting to the foul line, because he's so strong and physical. Like, the fouls the NBA is taking out of the league, those do not affect Julius Randle in any way. Like, that's just not going to happen. So I like the way that Julius Randle is playing. I really like the way RJ Barrett is playing. He looks a lot more comfortable. He looks tough. He looks physical in the same way that he always has, but seems to have a bit more poise and hesitation off the bounce that is causing more issues for opposing teams. And like you said, the spacing has really, really helped all of those guys play. Again, I will also note too, like, Mitchell Robinson, I think, has been really good on both ends for the Knicks so far. So, a really good team. I think that they are somewhere in that, like, 4 to 7, 4 to 8 range in the East. The East is deeper this year. But I feel good about where the Knicks are, and I think that they have very clearly consolidated the progress that they made last season.
Yeah, they've done a very good job. And I know this was mostly an offensive-focused question. If I could just give a quick shout-out to RJ Barrett's defense, that man's been getting after it this year.
Yep.
If we're talking about fringe, all defensive cases, like, I think he has one right now, what he's done as a wing defender.
Yeah, hot take. These rookies that get a ton of shit placed on them in terms of role early on in their careers, they probably won't have the best numbers. They probably will be inefficient. If I remember correctly, RJ Barrett, like, didn't even make the all-rookie team as, like, the number three overall pick. Now you look at him, like, look, he's not quite an all-star level wing, but if he became that by the time he's 24, I don't think anyone would be surprised, given that he's still 21. You got to give these guys that have a crazy high level role early on in their careers a lot of time before they can really figure things out, in my opinion. Number 13, Draymond Green has looked phenomenal to start the year. He's looked absolutely incredible, in my opinion. He is back to being the Draymond Green of old. He's flying around defensively. And look, like, the Warriors have been, like, one of my favorite teams to watch so far in the NBA, so I end up watching a lot of the Warriors. But I think that right now he might be my defensive player of the year pick league-wide. And on top of that, he's averaging 10 points, 9 rebounds, 7 assists. He's shooting 59% from the field. I guess that my question is, there was a lot of consternation about Klay Thompson not making the NBA 75 team. Look, like, I wouldn't have had a problem if Klay would have made that team. But to me, like, Draymond Green is the much more important cog for this Warriors group, and yes, has been throughout the course of their incredible run. I kind of think Draymond Green should be on the NBA 75 team, is where I'm with this. He literally has changed the way the NBA has defended over the course of an entire decade, and has been a critical cog as either the second or third best player on 3 NBA championship teams. Where's the love for Draymond Green to potentially make, like, an all, you know, NBA 75 team? Because to me, like, he's just had a much more impressive career than Klay Thompson. And that's all due respect to Klay Thompson, who I think is fucking incredible.
Like, I think that's fair. Like, yeah, Draymond has been, I don't want to throw, like, generational gets thrown around a lot, but he has been a generational defender with the way that he's kind of shifted the NBA wholesale. Like, him being able to operate at the five had everyone looking for the next Draymond Green and quickly finding out there's only one Draymond Green. Like, there's only one dude that has that kind of size, that kind of strength, and also has, like, the processing to go along with it. Like, you're just not going to find that brand of defender. And that's before getting into how that processing transfers on the offensive end, like, that aids him in the playmaking. The most important, well, I won't say most important, what's really impressed me the most with Draymond, because I knew the defense coming in, like, I'm glad that he's gotten a little bit more aggressive offensively. Maybe not so far as the three-point shooting, because he's barely taking them at this point, but he's kind of turbocharging his way into these floaters, into these shots at the rim. He's shooting, I think, 59% from two this year, which is a career high for him. And that's all that was really missing. Like, yeah, it would be great if he goes back to the 15-16 year where he's actually shooting well from three on decent volume. But, like, I don't know if that's still a point of contention for Steve Kerr in particular, or if Draymond's lost confidence in the jumper or what. At any rate, you just want him to be effective. I mean, you just want him to be aggressive. And I'm glad he's doing that in addition to the other stuff.
Yeah. No, I am a longtime mark for Draymond Green, and I would like to see him get his flowers. And I think that the level he's been at this year has been absolutely incredible. And the antithesis of that level has unfortunately been the Portland Trailblazers. Now, I preface this question by saying I know that they've won 3 games, like, in blowout fashion. I've watched the Blazers 4 times this year, and I happen to have caught all of their losses. So please, like, just know that that's where I'm coming from with this question. Like, that's been my sample so far this year. What do we think is going on with the Blazers? Like, their defense has been statistically okay, but it feels like that's noisy based off of, like, shot making. Like, teams get whatever shot they want against this Blazers team. Do we think that they can actually turn this around, or do we think this is kind of the end of this core's run?
I just don't love Dame and CJ at the point of attack for any defense. I don't love one of those guys, much less them as a duo. And I think that's just where a lot of it starts. You're able to, even if they're able to stay connected over a screen, like, their teammates are kind of anticipating them getting beaten. They're cheating over a half step or rotating a little bit early in anticipation of them being beat. So even when they aren't, they're still kind of giving up an opening for these corner threes or these above the break threes. So, like, it's possible that that kind of, like, shooting luck in particular, like, carries over. We've seen it happen before. But structurally, like, I don't know how this gets better. Well, I don't see how it gets much better. I appreciate them experimenting. Like, the Cody Zeller signing in particular allows them to play a little bit higher or play a little bit more aggressively in pick and roll. Like, I think having that as a counter, having a guy like Larry Nance Jr. who can fly around, like, that helps. But I don't know if it, I just don't know how much it shifts things for them, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like, it feels like this was a team in need of, like, a big change this summer. And look, like, you're not going to find someone who's a bigger fan of Larry Nance than I am. I am just an enormous fan of the way that he moves the ball, of the way that he defends. He flies around in help. He's really, really good on the ball on, like, four different positions, right? Like, I think that Larry Nance is a winning player, and I generally understood why you go after him, but I think this team needed more structural, bigger changes than that. And then on top of it, like, again, I like Norman Powell. I think Norman Powell's much better suited defensively at the two than he is at the three. Mm-hmm. So you're playing small across the back line. You have Larry Nance coming off the bench playing 17 minutes a night. I don't know where the defense comes from on this group. Cause like the other part of this too is like, yeah, Robert Covington is a very good backline help defender. Robert Covington can also get taken advantage of on the ball. Like if you switch a guard onto him, like he gets hit. So I just don't know structurally where the defense comes from with this roster. In terms of like on ball defensive ability, on a position by position basis.
That was actually going to be one of my quick follow-ups. Like, how have you felt about Robert Covington defensively this year?
Yeah, not great. not great. I've, you know, the last couple years, like I used to be a big fan of Robert Covington. But then like a couple of those playoff runs really kind of opened my eyes in terms of how defenses can actually attack him on defense because he is so upright. Like his legs are so long, his arms are so long that I feel like guards who can really bend and explode, like they can get by him. And because his limbs are so long, like whenever he has to change direction really quickly off the ball, I feel like, or on the ball, I'm sorry, he doesn't really do that as well as what you would anticipate from like an all defense team guy. So I just worry that they have too many players on this roster that can get switched onto the ball. Like they can play this drop coverage scheme as much as they want, but at the end of the day, you're still going to get guys switched onto poor matchups, and they have too many guys. They make it too easy for other teams to switch their best players onto advantageous matchups, like a bigger guy against CJ or Dame, or a smaller guard, you know, being able to drive on Robert Covington. I feel like it's too easy. They make it too easy on opposing teams.
Mm-hmm. It just puts them in these shootouts that they constantly have to win, and Dame hasn't shot the ball well to start the year. So
yeah, and that'll change. Like it's whatever. Like Dame will be great again. It's just, I don't know. I think this has run its course a little bit, is where I'm at in Portland. And that doesn't mean trade Dame. Like I'm not saying trade Dame, but I think they need to make a bigger move, like maybe moving CJ, who I think has been great to start the year. Or maybe it's moving Nurkic, who's a free agent at the end of the year. I don't know what you do, but you need to make a big move, I think. This isn't like a small fix situation.
Yeah, I'm right there with you.
Okay, let's take another quick commercial break, and then we're going to buzz through these last seven questions. Okay, we are back. Let's get through here to number 15. The Pacers finally got their second win last night, and Caris LeVert helped them look a lot better, a lot more competent structurally on offense. He had a really great game in terms of pick and roll synergy with Domantas Sabonis. But like they feel like another team that is primed for a shakeup. Just they have a new coach in Rick Carlisle who wants to run a different scheme than what they have run previously. It feels like they should be primed for a pre-deadline shakeup. Like, where are you at on the Pacers at this point?
I think it's about that time. Like, what made them a fun, like, potential Ben Simmons suitor is because they had, like, six guys who are just good that you kind of cobble together. But I think particularly in the front line, like, something has to give. And, like, if the early returns on Domantas Sabonis and I don't know how long it's going to hurt, but like if the early returns are that he can actually hold his own in like a hard hedging scheme and not look out of place like he did last year. Like if that's the thing, like at a certain point, then make him your five, trade Miles Turner.
Yeah.
Like if that's what you're going to commit to, do that, because they still haven't, they've had like marginal success with those two on the floor together. And like, that's cool. But if you want to move up at all, like, you need to have successful lineups, not marginally successful ones. And like, if that's the thing that's holding you back, then make the move.
Here's what I worry about with that, though. I wonder if, look, I don't think they've missed the window on trading Miles Turner. Like, some team will happily take Miles Turner. Like, don't get that twisted. But I wonder if they missed the window in terms of getting the most value for him, because like, Boston just signed Robert Williams to a large extension and has Al Horford, who's played really well this year, right? Cleveland, look, I think he'd be an incredible fit with Evan Mobley. Like, that would be the building of like a top five defense year after year. But they just signed Jared Allen to a big deal. Like, are they going to be in the market for a center? Like, maybe Milwaukee could see him as like the long-term, you know, replacement for Brook Lopez, but Brook Lopez has multiple years left on his deal. Maybe Detroit, but like, are you going to trade him in division? I'm a little bit skeptical. Maybe it's Golden State. Like, maybe that's Golden State's move, right? You go out and you get Miles Turner to anchor the defense, with Draymond Green, and then his floor spacing, helps them play well. Like, honestly, like that might be my favorite potential option. Like, doing something like Moses Moody, plus something else for Miles Turner at this point. Cause I, if Golden State did that, they'd probably be my like title pick, to be honest. I think they're pretty close to that level already. So maybe that is the move, but I wonder if the market's a little bit lessened right now than what it would have been in the past for Miles Turner.
I think that's a sound point, honestly. Even Rashawn Holmes just got the new deal in Sacramento, which I don't understand how he didn't get more than what he did. But
yeah, I agree.
Good on Sacramento for that, I suppose. I guess between Golden State and Charlotte, just because they have a lot of perimeter guys that they can cobble together, and they definitely need a center. Like, this is, I've seen enough Mason Plumlee.
Took 8 games, but I'm with you.
Yeah, that's like I've seen that. Like, Mason can be a 22-minute guy off the bench. Like, he can't be the starter on a playoff team. Yeah. That's not his ministry right now. But yeah, like, I should, and I also want to clarify, like, me saying, hey, split up the front court does not mean that those guys are not individually good. Like,
they're both Simonis, great. Honestly,
they're all-star cap. Yeah, like, I love Miles Turner. It's just, there's just a little bit more synergy that needs to be made with that roster. And like, that seems like the obvious point to make that adjustment.
Yeah, I agree. And Malcolm Brogdon, they can't move him because they signed him to that extension, so he can't be traded for 6 months. I guess Caris LeVert could be an option, but Caris LeVert and Sabonis like just had a really great game last night, and I want to continue to explore how that looks. You definitely don't move Chris Duarte, who's young and you have for a lot of cheap years. I think that it's just that Miles Turner is the man, like the odd man out more than anything, right? Like, you're probably building around Sabonis long term. Maybe it is Sabonis. Like, I can't imagine them moving Sabonis personally, but like, one of those two seems like the odd man out to me, and it just feels like Turner is the one. And I think Miles Turner is probably one of the 10 best defenders in the NBA. He has a case to be one of the 5 best defenders in the NBA, in my opinion. It's not a statement on him. It's just a statement on where this organization is going. And I feel like they need to do something a little bit differently.
They do. And I would just say, before we move off of Indy, getting TJ Warren back at some point would help. And I just have no, like, what's going on with TJ Warren?
Yeah, I have no idea. You know, it seems like there's a foot issue there with TJ Warren, and I don't know. And by the way, that was a tremendous transition, Nikias, because our next question is about another player with a foot injury. How worried are you about the entirety of the Zion Williamson situation? Because I am extremely worried at the moment.
Yes. That's pretty much the best way I can phrase. Yes, I just don't like the vibes coming out of New Orleans, period. Like, there's been so much weirdness surrounding Zion, his his people, New Orleans, the relationship they have with current and former players. It's just all very weird. And even the roster itself, it's something I wrote about in my division preview on them. Like, they have a lot of players I like. It's just, how do you fit the lineups to make things make sense? Like, can you feed everyone there? Like, it's just, there's just so much going on. And with Zion being removed right now, a lot of guys like Nikhil Alexander-Walker in particular, like, he's just over his head in terms of role right now.
Yep.
And that's just kind of making things worse. And now, like, Brandon Ingram's also been in and out of life. New Orleans is, I really hate it for him. I hate it for the fans there. There's just so much to worry about right now.
Yeah, like, I do too. Like, there are so many guys on that team that individually I really like. Like, I thought Jonas Valanciunas was a top six center in the NBA last year. I have no idea why they went out and traded for him. Like, I just have no idea why you go out and you move two first round picks for him. Or essentially, like, the value of two first round picks given the value they gave up in the 2021 NBA draft and then the additional future pick they gave up. I had Herb Jones as a first round pick last year. I had Trey Murphy as like a top 15 guy on my board last year. I really like Kyra Lewis as like an interesting project guard who's 20 years old and is still figuring things out. They've long been kind of in on Brandon Ingram, you know, being just as valuable, if not more valuable than, a lot of younger players. Like, his last year on his rookie scale deal, I think I had him sixth in the NBA in prospect rankings. I love all the individual pieces on this team. I don't think they've built a roster that makes any semblance of sense whatsoever.
Right.
And that's before we get to the Zion issue, right?
Mm-hmm. And all of this kind of culminates into the rumblings of Zion not being happy there or being, you know, questioning things long term. It's, you know, it's not enough to bring in talented players if you're a GM. You have to bring in talented players that fit together. And you know, of all the talk about the player empowerment era and stuff, and we don't have to get into that. One thing I will say, like, players are a lot smarter about this stuff. Like, they understand the importance of, like, lineup cohesion and stuff. It's not just, I want my shots, I want my money, and that's it. Like, they understand this stuff. They see what's being put together.
Yeah. Yeah, and, like, in the case of Zion, too, I mean, the guy looks heavy right now. Like, let's just say that, right? Like, I don't know what he weighs right now. I think the Bleacher Report had a report that New Orleans was concerned he was over 300 pounds or something like that. Like, he was out on the court for that Knicks game and people had cameras on him. He looked heavy, let's say. And look, he's wearing a sweatshirt, but even just his movement, they had him doing like defensive slide drills and he looked heavy at this point. You know, I would like to like put some onus on Zion too, to like, you know, let's get like into pristine game shape here at some point. But they just said like it's going to be 2 or 3 weeks until he's practicing, and that feels very concerning to me. It's on both parties here. It's on New Orleans for not making a roster that like makes him want to maybe get back on the court because this roster is a mess. And it's on Zion. Like, he needs to get into like the physical condition that he has to get into while also like being willing to, like, the fact that he thought he was going to play in the first game and now we're 8 games into the season. They're 7 games into the season. And he's still 2 to 3 weeks away from practicing. There's just a very clear inherent disconnect between the star and the team. And that is a real worry to me. That's a very real worry to me. Like you said, like, I feel bad for Pelicans fans because it feels like they have been like treated unfairly in this, because they have this star here and there's just absolutely no transparency from the organization regarding what his status is going forward.
Like, how do you get excited about the team if you don't know if your blue chipper is playing, and if he isn't, why he isn't? Like, heading into media day and be like, oh yeah, by the way, Zion had foot surgery. And it's like, what?
Yeah.
How is this a thing we're just now finding out? So it's a mess. It's a mess right now.
Okay. Let's go to number 17. If you were ranking players on the Lakers in terms of importance, how high would Austin Reeves rank? And I asked this question basically just to bring up the idea of how worried are you about the Lakers' depth and like the way that those depth veterans have played outside of Carmelo Anthony? Because I think that I would have Austin Reeves fifth on this roster in terms of importance right now.
I think I had him sixth, which the fact that we're in lockstep here is, it is a little bit concerning. Quick shout out to Carmelo Anthony, who has been lighting things up at home, at least. He's been lighting it up this season.
Yeah, so he's been great.
But yeah, like I am worried about the wing depth in particular. Like, as impressed as I've been with Austin Reeves on the defensive end, like he does still have inherent limitations there. And they're kind of banking on Kent Bazemore to kind of play above his head. Avery Bradley, when he gets wing assignments, he's mostly a point of attack guy. But they're counting on him to play above his head. When Trevor Ariza comes back, like, I thought he was pretty good defensively in Miami. Like, they actually trusted him with some point guard assignments last year. But, like, they're trusting him to defend at a high level off of this injury hiatus and also shoot well, which that's been a pretty inconsistent thing throughout his career. So, yeah, like, Reeves is right there. After like the big three and stuff. So I wish they had another wing. I really do wish they had another wing. They traded a lot of wing talent to get Russell Westbrook in the building. And like, I get why they made that bet, but you're also starting to feel it.
No, it's even simpler than that. Like, forget trading the wing talent. You want to make the Russell Westbrook deal? Okay, fine. Right? Like, go make the Russell Westbrook deal. Why in the fuck did you not re-sign Alex Caruso? Like, what are you doing, Los Angeles? You had a guy who signed with Chicago for $9 million a year, who's a borderline all-defense guy on a roster that desperately needs defense and desperately needs guys who are happy to be just the unselfish role player. And you let that guy walk over $9 million? You re-signed Talen Horton Tucker instead of Alex Caruso when you're trying to win a title right now? And like, no disrespect to Talen Horton Tucker, like, he might end up being really good, but there's no way that Talen Horton Tucker is helping you win a title this year more than Alex Caruso is. I just don't. And look, like, they signed similar deals. That's why I bring up Talen Horton Tucker, opposed to Alex Caruso and make the Lakers pick. They didn't really have to pick. They could have signed them both. But if you're picking one because of luxury tax issues, I don't understand, outside of like clutch machinations, why you pick Talen Horton Tucker over Alex Caruso. I do not get it.
Yeah. Like, I'm right there with you. I also don't get it. Like, the fact that they had to bring in Avery Bradley for some patchwork at the point of attack even further proves the point. Like, hey, you probably should have just wrote the check for Alex Caruso. Like, you're the Lakers. Like, you don't have to worry about luxury tax. Like, you have plenty of money coming in the barrel. Like, just retain your young talent that you find.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought up Trevor Ariza. Look, he had surgery on his right ankle and is going to miss, like, the first, 8 weeks of the season, something like that. Look, I have some concerns about what he'll come back, what he looks like when he'll come back. A, ankle injuries tend to have adverse effects on shooting. B, ankle injuries really might hinder his lateral agility, especially as he works his way back into the rotation. I think that it was a great signing. I think it was exactly what they needed to do. I just worry about what he looks like, and that creates some possible concerns for me. If I'm a Lakers fan, and if I'm running the Lakers roster at this point, like Rob Pelinka.
Yeah, I think that's a very fair, balanced way to put it. Just some concerns.
Okay. The Utah Jazz are averaging the second fewest passes per possession in the NBA right now. 2 years ago, they were in the top third of the league in passes per possession. Despite very little personnel change overall on this team, like, they've added Mike Conley over the last 2 years, but Mike Conley's an unselfish player, right? Like, it's not like he's going to hinder the ball movement. Do you think this style of play is sustainable? Do you think that it's more sustainable for them as they try to move toward playoff success?
Honestly, like, I've been thinking about it. Like, I'm just kind of on the fence about it right now. Like, I don't know how that, I hope I don't disappoint anyone with that answer, But like, it's interesting. Like, they have passed the ball a lot less this year, but they're also still generating a very, very, very high quality of shots.
Yep.
So it's not like that has materially changed who they are offensively. And I guess that's kind of the point. Like, if you can cut out some of the fat, I guess, if you want to phrase it that way, and still generate like 80% of your offense at the rim or from three, and you lead the NBA in like the percentage of shots coming from corner threes by a wide margin without passing as much, it's like, okay, why not? So I guess, I don't know. I guess my one worry there is that what we saw in the playoffs last year was Donovan Mitchell getting doubled a lot. And so I do worry about like what that's going to look like in the postseason if they do just try to force the ball out of his hands again, and if they have to kind of rev up the passing. But I don't know. Like, I'm still in data collection mode on that right now.
Yeah, I think I am too. I think part of the reason, look, Bob Vulgaris, who has just been such a tremendous addition again, go follow Harala Bob. I'm so excited that he's back. He kind of noted this on Twitter that every pass has on average a 3% chance of getting, of turning the ball over, essentially. And therefore, if you make five passes in a possession, you're already above the league average in terms of turnover rate, right? The Utah Jazz are still like 22nd in the NBA in turnover rate, despite the fact that they've run this style of scheme over the first six games, which is interesting to me in a number of ways. Like, I was surprised that they've been turning the ball over as much as they have. Like, Donovan Mitchell's averaging four turnovers per game. Rudy Gobert is still turning it over a little bit more than you'd like to see given his overall role. I'm definitely still in data collection mode like you are on this. I think that it probably could help them in the playoffs, and they're so good. They're such a well-oiled machine at this point. Like, I'm firmly on team, like, the Utah Jazz are probably going to have the best record in the NBA this year. I just find any sort of difference in what they're doing interesting. And the lack of passing, if you've watched them this year, has been startling. Like, it's a very clear difference in terms of the way that they're playing as opposed to the early Quinn Snyder years when they move the ball an awful lot.
Right. Do you think, before we move, like, do you think the passing being de-emphasized is because they've embraced not just three-point shooting, but pull-up three-point shooting in a way that they just haven't before?
Yes, I think that's probably true. I think that it's in part that. I think that there's probably an analytics factor because that organization is really smart and forward-thinking. And then on top of it, I think that they just have more guys who can generate pull-up threes than what they've had. Like, they get Jordan Clarkson, you know, a year or 2.5 years ago or whatever. They're really empowering him to shoot threes. Like, he's making 24% of them, and that will revert at some point. Like, he's a better shooter than that. Donovan Mitchell, I think, will make more than 31% of his threes. That's like the craziest thing to me also. Like, they are 5-1 right now, and they're shooting 32% from three with one of the best shooting rosters in the NBA. Like, they're only going to get better from this point.
Yeah.
Their scheme is so structurally sound in some ways that they're shooting 32% from three in a small sample size, and they're still top five in offense, right? Like, the Utah Jazz are just a buzzsaw on offense and on defense, frankly, in the regular season. I'm assuming that the lack of passing has to do with A, them being more analytically inclined, and then B, also them trying to ready their self-creative players for what the playoffs will look like. And that's at least interesting to me on a number of that's a very different way of playing than what we've seen in the past from them.
Yeah, we talked a little bit earlier about the Hawks maybe being in experimental mode. Like, the Utah Jazz absolutely have the credence to do that during the regular season.
Oh, totally. Like, 100%. Let's go to number 19. The Wizards are winning with depth. Kyle Kuzma's been good. KCP has been good. Spencer Dinwiddie and Montrezl Harrell have certainly given them more offensive firepower. Are we at the point where we just buy the Wizards as a playoff team now? They are sitting at 5-2, and they've certainly been the second best team in the division behind Miami Heat so far.
I just need to see more. And this is as, and I mean that in the literal sense. Like, I've only caught a few Wizards games so far this year. Like, I'm trying to spread the wealth during the regular season and then hone in a little bit later. Like, Washington is a team that I have not seen a lot of. So I just need to see more. When I have watched them, like, I've appreciated their activity defensively. Having better personnel on the wings in particular has helped that. But, like, they're flying around. Like, I'm watching the Hawks game. Like, they're trapping Trae Young on basically every pick and roll, and they're rotating behind it. Like, the effort is there. They're able to push and transition. And they have a lot of offensive firepower. So, if the defense is there, then they certainly have the upside to be just a flat-out playoff team. I need to see a larger sample, and I just need to see more of them generally before I have a firmer take on them right now.
Yeah, I think I just need to see more in terms of where everything settles for them. Bradley Beal has not really made shots yet, which is kind of scary for the rest of the league, that this offense has been top 10 in the league and Bradley Beal has not really made shots yet. Also, Spencer Dinwiddie has been just like, fine. He's been pretty good, like, in terms of distribution and running the show. He's actually been really good in that regard, but, like, it feels like there's even more latitude in the games I've watched when they've played some good teams for him to be able to, like, just shot make in a real way. The thing I will say is something that you said. They're much better defensively, and particularly, I think they're just fucking harder to play against. Like, Aaron Holiday will dog you up and down the court at the point of attack. KCP is a really, really tough physical defender. Kyle Kuzma has been good defensively this year. Daniel Gafford gives them an athletic presence in the front court that they didn't have, for a ton of minutes last year. You know, he's still only playing 17 minutes a game because Montrezl Harrell's been so good and they've been splitting the center position between those two. Like, I just think that they are harder for teams to play against in a real tangible way. And that's a credit to what they've done and a credit to how, frankly, Wes Unseld Jr. wants to build a roster, because Wes Unseld Jr. has long been the defensive coordinator of the Denver Nuggets. And I would imagine that it was a goal of his to make them much more difficult to play against structurally this year.
He certainly imparted that. Like, he definitely deserves credit there. It's incredible. Like, if you actually have wing defenders, you can do a little bit more on defense. It's not a thing that the Wizards could say last year. So kudos to them for adding that talent. I wonder what deal brought that talent in. Again, I just need to see more from Washington before I put my believer hat on.
Well, as we're recording, we mentioned earlier that we would love the NBA's competition committee to discuss the Eurofoul phenomenon. Shams Charania, sources: the NBA competition committee today discussed the uptick in transition take fouls this season and encouraged the league office to develop a rule change that would eliminate incentive to utilize the tactic in the future. Huh. I absolutely love that.
There we go.
What a
good on the league.
We've forced change, Nikias. We haven't even published this yet, and we've forced change throughout the league. They heard us talking. All of us are bugged somewhere, and, you know, the NBA league office has bugged us. Okay. Number 20, small sample size theater. Which top 10 defense do we buy the most to hold their short season sample over the course of the long term? Minnesota, Chicago, or Dallas?
My answer is Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Why?
I like Minnesota just because of their general activity level. Like, I'm glad that they finally have Cat player higher in pick and roll. I was so tired of watching him in drop coverage and looking like a fish out of water doing it. I could not stand it. I'm glad they're playing him closer to the level of the screen now. Josh Okogie, when they've had him in the lineup, he's literally been in guys' jerseys. Like, I am still laughing at what he did to Jalen Green in the opener. Like, it was just rude what he did to him and KPJ. But between Okogie, you have Jaden McDaniels, you have Jared Vanderbilt still. Patrick Beverley is doing Patrick Beverley things, but he's also still been pretty darn good at the point of attack. I've had more issues with him off the ball than on the ball, oddly enough. But I like their personnel. Like, among those three teams, at least, like, I think they have the most equity to pull it off.
Yeah, and I think that they have also made the most, like, tangible schematic change, like with the way that they're guarding ball screens is drastically different since Chris Finch took over than like what Chicago is doing with their new personnel and what Dallas is doing, right? Like Dallas still has to play, Kristaps Porzingis, like they can't really play him all that high, all that often. He's just not athletic enough to do that. I will say, like, Anthony Edwards, like, talked a lot about defense coming into the year. He's still, like, losing guys. There was that game against Orlando last night. Like, he had the Franz Wagner assignment a decent amount and just played way off of him in team defense and played off of him when he was, like, as an off-ball defender. He kind of would dig into ball handlers, you know, driving on the same side too often. And, you know, the Magic hit a couple of just easy same side kickouts to Wagner for open threes. And it was, you know, Anthony Edwards, that was kind of to blame on those. So I would like to see him continue to get just a little bit better in terms of his awareness defensively. But they're just very, they're a lot more athletic, I think, on the ball this year. Edwards is an athletic defender on the ball. Jaden McDaniels is a tough defender. You mentioned Okoji, like he's just a monster. I think Jared Vanderbilt's actually been really good defensively too. Like he gives them rebounding, he gives them toughness, he gives them athleticism and switchability. Like I think Minnesota is the pick here. I think you're absolutely right to choose them. I think that this team makes at least the play-in tournament. I think that that would be my, I think that, again, Bob Vulgaris, I think, said that they're going to be a top six team in the West. I wouldn't go that far, but I do think Minnesota makes the play-in tournament based off of what I've seen.
Yeah, they're playing for me. Like, they've been able to, not just straight up, like, they've been a successful team this, so far this season and oddly have not figured out the offense at all, which I expect that to course correct throughout the year. Like, Cat's too good. Anthony Edwards is good. Yep. D'Angelo Russell's good offense. Like, they have the personnel to be a good offense. So, like, I think that's going to course correct. And even if the defense regresses some, that they have a play-in formula.
Yeah. Okay. The last question is the question we ask everyone. It's the all-important number one question that we ask on this podcast. Have you accepted Alexei Pokuševski as your basketball lord and savior?
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, what a king. We saw the full Poku last night. He was incredible in the first half, and then just like completely and totally unplayable in the second half. Like, it was amazing. I watched the game this morning and I was like, oh yeah, this is exactly what I want from Poku. Like, I want him to play great for a half and go like 4-for-4 from the field, make some interesting passing plays, like, you know, be a 7-foot ball handler, and then come in the second half and the intensity ramps up and just gets totally lost defensively and like they have to pull him very quickly.
Like, just for entertainment purposes, like, every team needs a Poku. We need a Poku, we need a Bol Bol on every team, where it's just a very tall, lanky guy that has ball skills that are uncommon for his size, and you just don't know how applicable it is to NBA basketball yet. But, like, those guys should just be penciled in for, like, 8 minutes a game. I just need to see it.
I love him. Like, I can't get enough of watching Alexei Pokuševski every time he takes the court. It's honestly one of my favorite things in the NBA. Like, it's just such a weird mix of skills that I can't get enough of watching him. It's just, it's the absolute best. And he's been better this year. Like, last year was, it was messy. This year, he's at least like a non-disaster at, all times on the court. And by the way, people make jokes about second year players saying, oh yeah, he's still 19. Like, don't worry about it. When in reality, they're 21 years old most of the time. Like, Jason Tatum was 19 for many years on basketball. Yes. Twitter. Alexei Pokuševski is legitimately still 19 years old, still trying to figure out how to play in the NBA. And it is the best. And I am somewhere between, 0% sure and 100% sure that Alexei Pokuševski is a good basketball player.
And honestly, that's the only way to evaluate him. Like, that's just how that has to go.
Yeah. Nikias, tell the people where they can find you. Tell the people where they can find your work. Tell the people what's going on. Whatever you want to talk about. This is your window. This is your floor.
All right. Well, find me on Twitter at NikiasNBA. You can find my basketball takes with Steve Jones Jr. on the Dunker Spot. If you want more casual listenership, me and my good pal Jasmine L. Watkins host a podcast called You Late. We kind of recap the night in sports on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. So lots of jokes and banter there if you want a looser feel. Other than that, I'm just watching a bunch of basketball. So let's have fun this year.
That is absolutely fantastic. I love it so much. Go follow all of Nikias's podcasting work. Go follow his written work. He just wrote about OG Anunoby today, if I remember correctly, right?
Yes, yes. MIP is in play.
Oh, yeah, it is. I absolutely think that. This has been the Game Theory Podcast. Please remember, rate, review, subscribe, do anything you can to support the show. We will be back later this week. We're going to talk with Matt Penny about sophomores in the NBA, maybe some stuff on third-year players, but probably going to focus more on the sophomore class. Until next time, though, we will talk soon.